of Kings. But this is not the only attraction of the house. If you take a look around, you can easily breathe in the beauty that lies here.
You can imagine that house was considered to be a grand house about 130 years ago when it was commissioned. The people who lived here were the descendants of a Qajar prince called Abbas Mirza.
The Masudi House isn't the only historical monument in Tusar Khan. There are still plenty more left, and we're going to visit as many as we can.
If you search for the city of Tusar Khan on the internet, one of the first images you'll come across is a photograph of this mausoleum. This is where Habakkuk, one of the prophets in the Hebrew Bible, actually the 8th of the 12 minor prophets, was put to rest.
It's not only because of Habakkuk that this shrine is valuable. The architecture that has allowed this 12-meter-high mausoleum to survive some 900 years is also astonishing. From afar, it appears to have an octagonal form with the cone-shaped roof comprising 16 columns arranged in an interesting way. It is this architectural form that has allowed it to stand firm against storms and earthquakes. Tusar Khan's attractions aren't limited to man-made and historical sites. Apparently, there's more. Some of the locals gave us directions to a location that's home to one of the oldest living trees in Iran.
The 2,000-year-old Barvar sycamore tree. I'd hazard a guess that it's about 35 meters high, and it has a really thick trunk.
Tusar Khan is filled with old and resilient trees, most of which are walnut trees.
The city of Tusar Khan is famous for its top-quality walnut trees. So we've come to this walnut orchard to find out what all the fuss is about.
Walnuts actually grow inside a green husk inside which you have a hard brown walnut shell. The meat's inside the shell, of course. The first step in harvesting walnuts is to actually get them off the trees, and the easiest way to do that is by shaking the branches. And in Tusar Khan, it's done the traditional way.
The locals usually wait for the walnuts to ripen and for the husks to change color before they do this, because then they are able to shake the walnuts loose without harming the tree. People in different cities have different homemade dishes depending on the climate and the vegetation that grows there. Since Tusar Khan is literally filled with walnut trees, we're going to go and find someone who'd be able to prepare a local dish for us with walnut as the main ingredient.
During the Safavid dynasty, Shah Abbas the Great commissioned the construction of some 999 caravanserais throughout Persia, each of which was approximately 30 to 50 kilometers away from the other.
Okay, so we've arrived at the Shah Abbasi Caravanserai. In the old days, travelers and merchants would stop at these caravanserais to replenish their supplies and refresh before heading out again, maybe even sell a few bits and bobs.
It was built in the 11th century in the Safavid architectural style. Once in a while, travelers would have had to stay indoors for days at a time, protected within these high walls from thieves and bandits.
The images that come to mind when you think about all the events that took place here during those times. All the different people, the colorful clothes, the stories these walls would tell. If they could speak.
Final stop is the Artimani Mausoleum, which is where Mir Razioddin Artimani was put to rest. It's hard to believe that a mere 41 years ago, this site was in ruins when the Cultural Heritage Organization took up the task of rebuilding it. The mausoleum is symmetrical in shape and design, with three brick arches on each side. This is one of the four entrances, all of which have been decorated with these beautifully designed tiles.
The locals refer to him as Mir Razi. He was a very well-known poet and mystic back in the Safavid period. From what I've read, his sonnets and quatrains are very deep and moving.
We've only covered half of what Tuysarkhan has to offer, be it the vast areas of land decorated with natural foliage or whispers of a long-gone civilization. This is Gulnar Farnoodi for Iran.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you, and in this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the contents of Surah Al-Ankabut, or Chapter Spider, the 29th chapter of the Holy Quran. So, dear listeners, as you have been with us previously, we have reached the 10th verse of Surah Ankabut. So, before we start our discussion regarding this verse, let's listen to the verse under discussion.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
ومن الناس من يقول آمنا بالله فإذا أوذي في الله جعل فتنة الناس كعذاب الله ولئن جاء نصر من ربك ليقولن إنا كنا معكم أوليس الله بأعلم بما في صدور العالمين.
And of the people are some who say, "We believe in Allah." But when one of them is harmed for the cause of Allah, they consider the trial of the people as if it were the punishment of Allah. But if victory comes from your Lord, they say, "Indeed, we were with you." Is not Allah most knowing of what is within the breasts of all creatures?
So, in view of the fact that there were mentioned some explicit statements about the righteous believers in two or three of the previous verses, and also the statements about polytheism and polytheists were mentioned in the former verses, in this verse, the words are about a third group, which is hypocrites. So the verse says, وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَقُولُ أَمَنَّا بِاللَّهِ. And among the people, there are some of them who say, "We believe in Allah." فَإِذَا أُوذِيَ فِي اللَّهِ جَعَلَ فِتْنَةَ النَّاسِ كَعَذَابِ اللَّهِ. And when they are hurt in Allah's cause, they think the persecution of men as it were Allah's chastisement. وَلَئِنْ جَاءَ نَصْرٌ مِّن رَبِّكَ. And if help comes from your Lord, لَيَقُولُنَّ Inna kunna ma'akum. They will surely and certainly say, "Verily, we were with you." أَوَلَيْسَ اللَّهُ بِأَعْلَمَ بِمَا فِي صُدُورِ الْعَالَمِينَ. What? Is not Allah the best knower of what is in the breasts of mankind? So, this verse is implicitly saying that the expression of faith by some people is only oral, and it is not said by heart. وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَقُولْ أَمَنَّا. They only say that we believe in Allah. But the true faith will often be made manifest at the time of afflictions. فَإِذَا أُوذِيَ فِي اللَّهِ جَعَلَ فِتْنَةَ النَّاسِ كَعَذَابِ اللَّهِ. When they are hurt in Allah's cause, they think the persecution of man as if it were Allah's chastisement. Imam Ali alayhi salam, in this regard, has said, "The reality and essence of man will be known in the change of circumstances." So, وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَقُولُ آمَنَّا. There are some people, among the people, are those who say, آمَنَّا. The Arabic word آمَنَّا, we believe, is used in the verse in plural form, while the next phrase is in singular. Because it may be for the reason that this group of hypocrites want to be counted among the group of believers, so they say amanna, and they mean that they have believed like other people. So you see, these hypocrites are really careful and they are actually doing really tricky stuff in the society of Muslims, and that's why the Muslims need to be aware. So, as we were saying regarding this 10th verse of Surah Ankabut, these hypocrites are really careful in their manners in the society because they want to actually be considered with the other people of the society. So they say, Amanna. But, فَإِذَا أُوذِيَ فِي اللَّهِ, when they are hurt in Allah's cause, this means that they are hurt in the way of Allah. This means they are sometimes hurt in the way of Allah and faith by their enemies. So it is interesting that when speaking about the punishment of Allah, the Quranic word adab is used. But when it speaks about people's hurts, it uses fitna and trial. جَعَلَ فِتْنَةَ النَّاسِ كَعَذَابِ اللَّهِ. And this indicates that people's hurts are not in fact punishments, but they are trials in order to be completed by men in order to complete themselves. In this way, it teaches them that they might not compare those two with each other. And by the pretext that the opponents hurt and torture them, they leave out their faith because this is a part of total program of trial in this world. So, before we move on, there arises a question here that which victory had Allah bestowed on the Muslims in Mecca that hypocrites demanded to be part of it, that hypocrites demanded a share in it? The answer of it is that this sentence is a conditional sentence, and we know that a conditional sentence is not an evidence for the existence of the real condition happening actually, but its concept is that if there will be some victories for Muslims in future, these feeble faith hypocrites will demand share in it. Moreover, the Muslims gained some victories against enemies in Mecca, though they were not martial, and they were some victories in the fields of propagation or penetration in public thoughts, and the development of Islam amongst the different levels of people, but yet they demanded share in it. And the application of the word hurt, فَإِذَا أُوذِيَ فِي اللَّهِ, actually fits the environment of Mecca. Else, in the environment of Medina, such a thing rarely actually happened. But, however, this point was also made clear that the term hypocrites is not only used for those who have never faith inwardly and do not express faith, but those feeble faith people who, under the pressure of this and that individuals, soon change their belief and are counted among hypocrites. And the holy verse under discussion apparently speaks of this kind of hypocrite and announces that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is aware of their intentions. أَوَلَيْسَ اللَّهُ بِأَعْلَمَ بِمَا فِي صُدُورِ الْعَالَمِينَ Is Allah not the best knower of what is in the breasts of mankind? Thank you for staying with us in this episode as well. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
The picturesque town of Kasimov, deep out there in the endless plains of rural Russia. It was a grand town once, wealthy in imperial times. The Russian Tsar came to visit. Now it is as much known for tourism as anything else. With its rich history and idyllic location above the Oka River, there is also a stunning 600-year-old mosque. This land is where Europe and Asia meet. I'm here to speak to Austria's former foreign minister, Karin Kneisel. She has effectively been exiled from Europe because she promoted good relations with Russia. And she now calls this beautiful town of Kasimov her home.
Mrs. Kneisel, the Americans recently concluded a deal to operate the Zanzibar corridor through Azerbaijan. It's been given a very Trumpian name, the Trump route for international peace and prosperity. Particularly the Iranians seem a bit worried about this. Are they being paranoid, or are they right to be worried?
No, well, if I put myself in the place of the Iranian government, and also I would say average Iranian, I would also be worried. I would not be amused, to put it in a British way, because it means that this lease of Armenian territory by the U.S. Government, by a group of security companies, logistic companies, which are all somehow related to security agencies, they are just at in the very close geographic proximity of the Islamic Republic of Iran. So I can fully understand their second thoughts.
We know this region is very important for Russia and Iran. It links the two countries. We also know that Russia is effectively at the moment fighting a war against NATO, and that some NATO countries are interested in the Caucasus as well to destabilize perhaps both countries, Russia and Iran. There have been some commentators in Russia who are really sounding the alarm over what is happening there. Do you think it is dangerous to have the Americans controlling this corridor for the Russians as well?
Well, I would say it could cause some hiccups for a number of countries, also for Turkey, because, of course, this corridor opens trade possibilities for Turkey. But on the other hand, they have American security agencies just in front of the door. It could also cause hiccups for China, because the People's Republic of China has been constructing its Go West corridor, the Belt and Road Initiative, for the last 12 years. So here, all of a sudden, they have now some sort of new trade scheme, which might conflict with their trade schemes. Plus, and here comes Russia into the game, Russia and Iran are building up the North-South trade corridor, which is an interesting combination of different forms of transport. It would involve river navigation on the Volga River. It would involve container on different highways that have been constructed, plus also maritime transport. So the North-South corridor, which is a very ambitious project, not yet really implemented. Here, I think that the Russians could be, well, again, let me say, not too much amused. This from a trade point of view, from a national security point of view, and the critical voices that you can read and hear here in Russia about this scheme. And you said they're sounding alarm. Yes, I also read these bloggers and listen to these commentators. I think what they would like to point out is the following. The Caucasus, the Southern Caucasus in particular, has always been a hot spot of rivalry, of all sort of ethno-tribal warfare, plus great power politics. The so-called great game, it did not concern only Central Asia. It was also all about this rivalry between the British Empire, the Russian Tsarist Empire, and the Indian Empire, which was more and more eaten up by the British, and of course the Persian Empire, which under the dynasty of the Qajar was totally unable, military unable to make sure that it would not lose territory. And it was the Persian Empire under the Qajar dynasty that lost territory. It lost Armenia. It lost Azerbaijan to Russia, and later on Azerbaijan and Armenia were part of the Soviet republics, and it lost other parts of the Caucasus. So this region has seen some wandering frontiers, and so it has always been some sort of hot spot, and you can easily instrumentalize a small group to make troubles. And plus, the Caucasus is a corridor, as this Trump corridor says. And when we take, for instance, the pipeline that BP built in the early 2000s, going from Baku in Azerbaijan via Tbilisi, the Georgian capital, to Ceyhan in Turkey. This pipeline, let me recall for our audience, was only possible after a war in Chechnya. And maybe this pipeline project by BP, British Petroleum, Beyond Petroleum, whatever you would like to call them, they call themselves Beyond Petroleum, but sometimes they act as British Petroleum when they're in troubles. And this company maybe was also involved, I have no evidence for that, but maybe was involved in certain changes that we saw in Georgia in the early 2000s. The pipeline initially was conceived as crossing Chechnya. And that was a great momentum for the Chechens to fight for independence because they thought, oh, we have a transit fee that will be our income. So it's all interconnected. And we know the troubles that the Chechen war made. And there were two big Chechen wars, one in the early 1990s and the second one in the early 2000s. So there are many, many elements that if you add all of them up together, you can see the powder keg.
So I read an article recently in an American foreign policy magazine saying that the Americans can try and sell this to the Russians because it's important to get Russian support, or at least not too much opposition from them, to sweeten the deal for Russia so that Russia can benefit from it economically as well. Do you think any kind of deal in the Caucasus will be tied to, as you say, the great game, maybe even conversations in Alaska, at least the Trump administration trying to bring Russia closer to the United States? Do you think Azerbaijan can be a part of that?
Well, Azerbaijan is not an isolated element. Azerbaijan is connected, as we see, to whatever is happening in Turkey. And here the question is, who controls who, if I may say, or who monitors who? Is it Ankara, which does it with Baku, or maybe a Baku that somehow monitors Ankara? It depends on the situation. Plus, we have, of course, also the big actor, China, for which the Caucasus and this entire region is the entry gate to their markets. And Turkey is an important market. I would say it's much more important than whatever remains of Europe because demographically speaking and financially speaking, Europe is not such an interesting market in the long run. But Turkey is, and Russia is, and the Caucasus really have to understand it in its geographic importance. And the old German statesman Otto von Bismarck said once upon a time, without using the word geopolitics, but maybe he was one of the first geopolitical thinkers, he said, geography is the constant factor of history. Geographie ist die Konstante der Geschichte. And we see the return of geography on all levels. So such a corridor across Armenian territory to connect two pieces of land belonging to Azerbaijan, but at the same time very close to the border with the Islamic Republic of Iran, all that makes a lot of people think twice.
Do you think it could lead to war?
We are in a series of frozen conflicts there. None of those conflicts has been truly resolved. What was signed in Washington on the 8th of August was not yet a peace agreement. It was a memorandum. It was exchange of documents. I don't want to underestimate the importance of that meeting, the signature by both presidents, Aliyev and Pashinyan, together with President Trump, but it's not yet a peace treaty. And whatever we have seen in the 90s, none of this conflict is really solved that you can speak of peace. We have many fragmented territories there. We have, by the way, the great Russian writer Lev Tolstoy and also Mikhail Lermontov, they were both shaped by their soldiers' life in that region. So you cannot imagine a masterpiece like War and Peace, the epic, the big epic of Russian literature, without the Caucasus.
And what do you think it says about Iranian-Russian relations? How would you assess that now? It's flashpoints like this, disagreements that do does throw up questions about how important these two nations are to each other. There are some who believe there is a global war going on between the East and the West, that Iran's survival and security is essential for Russia, and indeed vice versa. Would you go that far, or can there be disagreements between them?
Between Washington and Moscow?
Between Tehran and Moscow.
Ah, between Tehran and Moscow especially. Of course, there can be agreements and disagreements, and it's not a kind of smooth path that they will converge on everything and anything. There is now a growing partnership. It has recently been boosted up by also some military exchanges, which did not exist beforehand. Russia and Iran are neighboring countries which share the Caspian Sea, which is not a sea, it's a lake, because it's not connected to the open sea. And we have always had there all sorts of troubles in the Caspian Sea, whether it was fishing rights, whether it was drilling, oil and gas, pollution coming with that. So this lake, the Caspian Lake, is definitely one of the many points of divergence, because there had been problems in the past, and they managed in 19th century to settle certain things. Also, let us recall that the times of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union existed until 1991, and the Islamic Republic of Iran got into existence in 1979. On the one hand, you had the so-called Azeri-ist Communist Empire. On the other side, the one party that was considered as a not always accepted opposition was the Tudeh Communist Party in Iran. There were also all kinds of accusations about interference. We have seen in history, we see in present day, also points of divergence. But of course, it's all a matter of how you handle that. I always say, for me, Russia is a country of the East. It's not Europe. Some people might not like it, but why do I say, luckily, it's a country of the East, like Iran? The East knows the many shades of gray, while the more you go to the West, especially the Europe of these days, it's all about black and white. So you're either with us or against us. Having traveled to Iran on many occasions, living now in Russia, having somehow grown up in the Arab West Asian countries, I more and more know how to cherish this opaque grayish. As a person with, if you want, some Germanic background, of course, at certain instances in my life, it troubled me, because I said, it's so Byzantine, it's so opaque, it's not clear, I want to see more clearly. It's corrupt, you can also say, but it gives you the possibility to live next to each other, not necessarily with each other, but next to each other. And this is the mastery of the Easterners.
Let me turn to the horror that's happening in Gaza and wider Palestine. Sergei Lavrov recently said that by the time European leaders get around to recognizing Palestine, it will no longer exist. What do you think he meant by that, and do you agree?
Yes. We are in real time witnessing a genocide. While we talk to each other, most probably the 60,000 Israeli reservists are called up to make their final attack on Gaza City. What we see is a genocide in real time. And many many countries have called a spade, President Putin said already in autumn 23, what is happening in Gaza reminds him of the Leningrad blockade, of the starvation of a city during 1,000 days. This is what is going on. Many EU capitals remain silent, not all of them. Ireland, Spain, they opened their mouth. But when we take countries like Germany and Austria, they are just quiet.
What is happening in Germany, I know Austria a little less, but in Germany particularly, if you protest for Palestine, you're arrested now. It seems, particularly Germany, seems...
Also Austria.
And Austria as well.
Yeah.
It seems disturbing the level of protection they are giving to, as you say, this genocide in Israel.
Yeah. And it's not only political circus, it's not only the media. It's nearly impossible to be slightly critical of Israel. It's in German we say the antisemitismus keule, it's the stick of antisemitism that is immediately used against a person when you want to cause him or her troubles. That happened to me. I happened to speak Hebrew, I happened to speak Arabic, first thing I was called when I was appointed or when my name was in discussion about becoming maybe Minister of Foreign Affairs, there were immediately press releases and press lobby campaigns to call me an anti-Semite. And this people are very much afraid of that because it can destroy your career, it can make you lose friends. Germans and Austrians in general are very much prudent, coward on that topic.
Who can help the Palestinians now? It seems the world has forsaken them. Who can really help them?
The Palestinians were always left in the rain by the Arab brothers. And when the whole disaster started in October 2023, I was not very sure that there would be some support by Arab and Muslim brothers. We saw also with the late Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah of Hezbollah, they were not about entering in a fully-fledged confrontation with Israel because of what was going on in Gaza. There was a lot of political discourse, but Nasrallah and many of his members were killed despite the fact that they did not want to have an open conflict with Israel. And there was criticism by Palestinians and in Lebanon also. The only people that is really, if you want, interfering in a certain way is Yemen. So otherwise, whether you take the Arab monarchies of the Arabian Peninsula, whether you take huge countries like Egypt, bordering to Gaza, the Philadelphia corridor, we see that the Palestinians, not for the first time in their history, are left in the rain by their brothers and sisters in the Arab and in the Islamic world by and large.
I sometimes think that how the Arab states are not doing anything to help Palestinians. But then I think of Europe, when in European countries, not only doing nothing for the Ukrainians, they're throwing them to their deaths. Mm. So I sort of get some perspective on wondering who is worse. The Russian position seems is still a two-state solution in Palestine. Increasingly I see anti-Zionist scholars and activists and spokespeople increasingly turning against that idea of that a two-state solution is possible. Do you think the Russian position is still correct? Do you think it'll change?
Well, first of all, I would say it's good that it's recalling, it's reminding the rest of the world. People, we have a UN Security Council list of resolution on the need for a two-state solution, but for many it has become more a ritual than a real political topic. And when President Putin was asked 1 or 2 years ago, so what's the solution to the turmoil in the West Asian region, he said the core of the problem is the Palestinian question and we need a Palestinian state. I don't know any current head of state, prime minister in any country that would be so clear about it. You know, yes, maybe South Africa. But many would tell you, well, problem is the realization, the problem is where would be a viable Palestinian state. And with the current settlement decisions of Male Adumim, which would truly cut off East Jerusalem from the West Bank, from West Jordan land, there's little protest in the in the Western world. There's so Russia, two-state solution, not only as a ritual, but reminding that this is necessary. Now, how to put that into action? Some 35 years ago, I wrote my PhD thesis about that. And the one of the scenarios that I developed is you have to move away from territorial federalism to personal federalism, as it was in the Ottoman Empire. I don't want now to say how great and fantastic the Ottoman Empire was, but in that empire, you could speak your language, live your religious way of life in a federal way. The milieu were conceived like that. How to draw borders, how to get rid of hundreds of thousands of Jewish settlers in the West Bank, in the occupied territories, it's a huge question. And we see now what's going on in Gaza, that those 8,000 Jewish settlers who were carried out by the Israeli army back in 2006, they're coming back, their children, grandchildren are back. And we see a demographic change in Israel due to the fact also that it's the national religious settlers who have more children. So whatever remains of a secular Israel is disappearing also in the demographic sense, because there are fewer and fewer of them. There are 200,000 demonstrating and asking for the resignation of Mr. Netanyahu and wanting to have the hostages back, wanting them to have some sort of agreement with Hamas. But the large, large majority today of Israel is national religious, votes for extremists, and it's all about recreating a greater Israel, an Eretz Israel. With
how far do you think that greater Israel is the plan?
Well, according to their plans, it's where the 12 tribes of Abraham's descendants settled. So this encompasses southern Syria, where they are. It encompasses Jordan, which Transjordan was created by the British as Transjordan, as a little present to the Hashemites, so that they are not too unhappy that they didn't get an Arab empire. It encompasses South Lebanon, where they were between 1982 and 2000, and they are back there. They're destroying whatever they can destroy in South Lebanon today. It encompasses parts of this area, the Sinai Peninsula, where they were between 1967 and 79, when this territory was lost and given back then to Egypt. So there are no borders. And I keep saying the big drama of West Asia is Israel has never defined its territory. This is the fundamental problem.
And do you think the problem is Netanyahu, or do you think the problem is the ideology of Zionism? Do you think it will just simply not stop?
Netanyahu definitely is a huge problem. But there are different schools of thinking in Zionism. I'm not a big expert on that, but you will find schools of Zionism in the very early days who didn't care about Palestine. You know, for them it was all about a Jewish state, which could have been in Madagascar, which could have been in southern Argentina. But you have, of course, also the national religious version of Zionism. And among those, as I said, there's a demography that is changing, and a lot truly changed in the early 1990s when you had the influx of about a million emigrants from the former republics of the Soviet Union. A lot changed. I have seen the Israel of the 1980s, which demographically speaking was oriental. You know, it was getting more and more oriental. There were, I worked in a hospital which was just right to the old city, and Israelis would go to the old city of Jerusalem on Shabbat when everything was closing down in West Jerusalem, because there the hairdressers were open, there they could do shopping, which they could not do in West Jerusalem. I played basketball in a team where we did not ask anybody, what are you? We were Armenians, Greek Orthodox, Jews, and Arabs, and one Austrian. So that was a different Jerusalem I knew. And it was more a kind of oriental country, if I may say, because demographically speaking, back then, you had immigrants from Iran, you had immigrants from Iraq, from Northern Africa, who were the Sephardic Jews, who were closer to their Arab neighbors than those Jews who came initially from Poland, like Ben-Gurion and others, who had deep despise for these Arabs. And then you had more than a million ex-Soviet citizens who came, who did not even anymore bother about learning Ivrit because they could do anything in Russian. They have Russian-speaking political parties, they have Russian-speaking TV channels. And President Putin recently said, Israel is quasi a Russian-speaking country.
Finally, let me ask you about, do you fear there may be another war between Israel and Iran?
Yes, because nothing has been solved. We did not even have a clear ceasefire. The copyright about the 12-day war goes to Donald Trump, who said after the last bombings in mid-June, let's call it the 12-day war. Let's call it. But we have the Israelis who keep saying, the moment we think it's necessary to bomb, we will bomb again. So it's total arbitrary. And whenever Mr. Netanyahu has a problem in his government, he will bomb whoever. Once he bombs Lebanon, then he bombs Iran, then he bombs Syria, because he has some problem at home. And for Iran, of course, would you just watch, sit by and watch what is going on in West Asia? Who will stop the Israelis?
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. English Radio.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked an
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of عمل انسان بعد از
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech. The best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. Please stay tuned.
در دنیا خدا مالکه، اما مالکیت خدا رو ما دیر احساس میکنیم.
In this world, God is the master, but we are late in feeling his mastery, because the glitters of this world dazzle us. For example, when we recover from an illness and are healed, we say, May God have mercy on the doctor's father. What a good medicine. What a beautiful injector. It worked. But we do not say, God made this injection effective. In this world, these manifestations, that is the means, prevent us from truly and fully grasping God's mastery. Therefore, on the day of judgment, everything is severed. All means are cut off.
سوره بقره آیه 166 همه اسباب قیچی میشه.
As the Quran says in Surah Al-Baqarah, Ayah 166, all their ties are severed. Kinship perishes. Also in Surah Al-Mu'minun, Ayah 101, we read that kinship perishes. Then no ties of kinship will remain between them. Wealth and children of are no avail. Wealth and children will be of no avail. Relatives and close ones provide no benefit. The tongue is not permitted to apologize. Intellect and thought no longer have the opportunity to devise plans. On that day, sovereignty is gone. Power is gone. The power has perished from me. Family is of no use. There, one finally understands, alas, I have no one. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. To find out more about this program and our other programs, please log on to our website, iranradio.ir. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Say that love strikes only once, that precious moment I offer you. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of hope? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest rose? You are my guiding light that walks me through the night. Your presence gives me strength, gives vision to my sight. Someday faith will increase, someday our wars will cease, someday.